You're listening to DTFHN for July 2nd, 2026. I'm your open sourcer guy host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build things argue about who really owns them. Today's a day for asking who holds the keys and whether you ever got a copy. Let's get into it. One of the top comments on this thread nails the real fear in about two sentences. If some wayward algorithm decides it doesn't like you, it won't just nuke your app. It'll probably nuke your 20-year-old Gmail, your Google Drive, your photos, everything. That's not a hypothetical. That's a pattern. And now Google wants to extend that same capricious authority to every Android developer on the planet. Let's break this down to what's actually happening. Google has shipped a system service called Android Developer Verifier to roughly 4 billion devices. It runs with root privileges. It can't be disabled. It can't be removed. And when activated, it does exactly one thing. Aux apps from developers who haven't registered with Google, paid Google, handed Google their government ID, and agreed to terms where the word malware means whatever Google decides it means on any given Tuesday. F-Droid is calling it what it is, malware. And honestly, run through the checklist. Installed without meaningful consent? Yes. Run silently in the background with elevated privileges? Yes. Awaits remote activation to restrict device functionality? Yes. Cannot be removed by the device owner? Yes. The fact that it comes from Google instead of some sketchy APK forum doesn't change the technical reality. It changes the scale. This isn't infecting thousands of devices. It's 4 billion. The stated justification is malware recidivism. Bad actors who get caught and come back with new signing keys. A real problem, sure. But as the article points out, there are far less authoritarian solutions. Enhance. Play protects on-device scanning. Implement federated verification so users choose their own trusted curators. Instead, Google chose the option that happens to make them the sole gatekeeper for all Android software distribution worldwide. Funny how that works. The comment section is full of people pointing to alternatives. Graphro Sailfish OS, Post-Market OS. And that's the right instinct. But one commenter cuts deeper. Android's entire pitch was being the open alternative to Apple's walled garden. That was the deal. Openness got them to 4 billion devices. And now that they're there, they're pulling the ladder up. This is the part that matters. The Android open source project is still technically open. You can fork it. You can build on it. But when the dominant distribution channel requires central registration with a single corporation that reserves the right to define what software is acceptable, the openness of the source code becomes a technicality. The control point moved. It's not in the code anymore. It's in the distribution layer, and Google just locked it. The phone is either yours or it isn't. Right now, 4 billion people are finding out the answer. Moving on. And you want Orange Diet, I'm about the decision that accidentally changed everything. They built the PC from off-the-shelf parts and published the technical reference manual. Anyone could clone it. IBM thought their brand would protect them. Instead, Compaq reverse-engineered the BIOS in a clean room. And within 5 years, the clone market was bigger than IBM's own PC division. The open architecture won. Not because IBM wanted it to, but because the economics were inevitable. 45 years later, GitHub just did something that rhymes. Kimi K2.7 code, built by Moonshot AI, is now a selectable option inside GitHub Copilot. First open-weight model in the model picker. You can choose it the same way you'd choose Claude or GPT. Same interface, same integration, same workflows. But the weights are open. The engineering here deserves attention. K2.7 is a mixture of experts architecture. The model activates only the parameters it needs for a given token, which is how you get frontier class code generation at input pricing around 95 cents per million tokens, with cash hits at 19 cents. That puts it roughly at GPT 5.4 mini pricing, while competing on quality with models that cost 5 to 10 times more. One commenter ran it for an hour and called the results promising. Another pointed out that people have been asking for exactly that. A way to use Chinese-developed open models through a trusted Western provider with Azure's compliance and data governance underneath. This is the pattern that matters. GitHub isn't just adding another proprietary model to a dropdown. They are validating that open-weight models belong in production tool chains, side by side with closed competitors, on equal footing in the interface. The model picker doesn't say experimental or community. It just says Kimi K2.7 code, right there next to Sonnet and GPT. And the pricing pressure this creates is real. When an open-weight model can match proprietary performance at a fraction of the cost, every closed model has to justify its markup. That justification gets harder every quarter. One commenter captured something worth noting. They've lost interest in cloud AI products entirely, frustrated by price hikes and disappearing features. That's the tax closed systems charge. The antidote is exactly this. Open weights, multiple hosts, no single point of failure for your workflow. The weights are published, Azure runs the inference, GitHub handles the integration, and 1,000 teams who couldn't justify Opus tier pricing for every autocomplete just got a real alternative. This is how open models enter the mainstream. Not through ideology, but through the model picker. But what happens when open models get so good, they start proving mathematical theorems? Story 3, the fall of the theorem economy. One of the most valuable thing a mathematician produces is the one the system doesn't know how to reward. David Besses makes a case that lands with surgical precision. His best theorem was never published. His second best was trivial to prove. The hard part, in both cases, was building the conceptual language that made the theorems obvious. Definition 2.4, definition 9.3. The scaffolding, not the building, and academic mathematics has no real mechanism for valuing scaffolding. The economics here are worth stating plainly. A mathematician spends months, sometimes years, developing an intuition, a way of seeing a problem that makes the solution self-evident. Then they spend more months translating that intuition into the format the system accepts. A theorem stated formally, proved rigorously, submitted to a journal, reviewed by peers. The insight is the scarce resource. The proof is the packaging. But the packaging is what gets counted, cited, and rewarded. Dazes describes a preprint where the real contribution was two definitions. The theorem they enabled has been cited dozens of times. The definitions traveled into a 700-page book. The actual innovation, the conceptual framework, propagated freely precisely because it wasn't locked behind the formal publication machinery. This is an architecture question. The theorem economy is a closed system. It has gatekeepers, journals, review boards, tenure committees, and a narrow definition of what counts as output. The understanding economy, the one Thurston described, is open by nature. Definitions propagate. Conceptual frameworks get adopted, extended, remixed. They work exactly like open source code. The value multiplies when people can touch it, modify it, build on it. Besses walked away from academia and built a machine learning company. His unpublished intuitions kept generating value. One commenter noted this might be the most interesting essay on the nature of mathematics they'd ever read. Another worried that AI panic had reached the field. Both missed the deeper point. The question isn't whether AI will replace theorem proving. It's whether the discipline can finally decouple its reward function from the artifact and attach it to the understanding. Because right now, mathematics optimizes for a proxy metric. the people who see furthest? Who build the conceptual infrastructure everyone else builds on? Are the ones most likely to go uncredited? That's not a philosophical problem. That's a systems design flaw. Moving on. Let me be honest about the strongest argument against this project. You can buy a robot vacuum with LiDAR navigation for £70. Fully assembled, warranty included, works out of the box. The components alone for Umwu. A Raspberry Pi 5, a LiDAR sensor motors, a custom PCB filament for the chassis. Will cost you more than that finished product. One of the top comments on Hacker News says exactly this, and the math checks out. So why would anyone build one? That's the question everyone's avoiding, and it's the wrong question. Nobody asks why someone builds a kayak in their garage when you can buy one at REI. Nobody interrogates the economics of a home-brewed beer that costs more per ounce than the craft stuff at the store. The price comparison only sounds devastating if you think the point of building something is to save money. It isn't. The point is to understand it. And understanding is where the comedy starts. Because here's what happens when you buy that 70-pound LiDAR vacuum. It works great for 14 months. Then, the app requires a firmware update. The firmware update requires a new account migration. The account migration requires accepting new terms of service that include telemetry you didn't agree to the first time. Your vacuum now uploads your floor plan to a server in Shenzhen. You don't know this because you didn't read the terms. Nobody reads the terms. The vacuum still works. Technically, until the company gets acquired, the cloud endpoint goes dark, and your $300 appliance becomes a very heavy frisbee. Umwu runs ROS 2, maps with local SLAM, integrates with Home Assistant, and never phones home. Not because the creator is paranoid, but because that's just how you design it. If your incentive was making a good vacuum instead of building a recurring revenue platform. The modular contribution model is genuinely clever. Dustbin design, blower assembly, coverage algorithms. Each one a self-contained pull request. 1,000 people tinkering on whatever interests them, best solutions servicing through use. This is how open hardware actually gets built. Not by one hero in a garage, but by a community that treats the bill of materials like source code. Forkable, improvable. Yours. Someone in the comments asked whether there's an open WRT equivalent for robot vacuums. Just flash custom firmware onto commodity hardware. That's probably the faster path to adoption. But Umwu is doing something more ambitious. It's building the reference design that makes that future possible. The blueprints that let the next person start from understanding instead of reverse engineering. The name reads the same upside down. The philosophy should too. Flip the entire value proposition of a robot vacuum on its head and it still works. That's the test. Umwu passes it. Open hardware needs open intelligence to run on it. Pause in GLM 5.2, just got a harness that makes that practical. Separation of model and tooling is as important as legislative and judicative. That's a direct quote from one of the commenters on this story, and it deserves to sit with you for a moment, because it might be the most important sentence written about AI development tools this year. Z-Code is a new desktop harness for GLM 5.2. Jipu AI's latest model, it looks polished. The demo they showcase is a browser-based Gomoku game with heuristic AI. Candidate move visualization. The works. The tooling integrates with nearly every popular command line agent out there. On paper, It's a reasonable product, but it's not open source. And that single architectural decision changes what Z-Code actually is. It's not a tool. It's a dependency. There's a difference. Run this forward 5 years. Every serious software team will have an AI coding harness at the center of their workflow. It will see every file, every commit, every design decision, every proprietary algorithm. It will be more intimate with your code base than any employee. Now ask yourself, do you want that layer to be a black box controlled by a company whose incentive structure you cannot audit? The commenter who flagged this pointed to MIMO Code, Xiaomi's open source alternative. Open Code is another. Cloud Code's protocol is documented. The landscape of open harnesses is growing precisely because engineers understand what's at stake. The harness layer is infrastructure. And infrastructure you don't control is infrastructure that controls you. What makes this worth taking seriously is the pricing model. Z-Code advertises a base usage allowance included with plans, then layers higher tiers as multipliers of that base, without ever disclosing what the base actually is. Multiple commenters flagged this pattern across several AI tooling companies. It's the gym membership model applied to developer tools. Obscure the unit economics. Make cancellation feel like losing something you already paid for. And let inertia do the rest. The model itself might be excellent. GLM 5.2 could be genuinely competitive. That's beside the point. The question isn't whether the engine is good. The question is whether you own the car or whether you're renting the steering wheel. Open harnesses exist. They're maturing fast. MIMO Code, Open Code, and others are proving that you don't have to trade control for capability. The engineers building these tools understand something fundamental. The layer between you and the model is the layer that matters most. It's where your data lives, where your workflows crystallize, where lock-in takes root if you let it. Keep that layer open. Everything else is negotiable. We talked about tools that feel right in your hands. Pause. Let's get literal. Story 6. My favorite keyboards. Every musical instrument shapes the music played on it. A Steinway Grand doesn't just reproduce what the pianist intended. It suggests possibilities, rewards certain touches, punishes others. The instrument is a collaborator, and for 40 years, programmers have been choosing their collaborators with exactly this kind of care, even if most people think they're just picking a keyboard. Fabian Sanglard's tour through his favorite keyboards reads like a luthier's memoir. He found IBM Model MIS stacked 6 feet high in a dilapidated Toronto computer shop, bought a few for $20 each, and Frankenstein together one pristine unit he used for a decade. That's not shopping. That's restoration. That's the same impulse that drives someone to rebuild a 1960s Fender Telecaster from salvaged parts. Because the thing that was mass-produced 30 years ago had qualities that nothing manufactured today quite replicates. The Concertmaster detail is where this gets genuinely fascinating. The NMB RT9100 Watt shipped at standard with Intergraph workstations, and John Carmack liked it enough to keep it through the development of Quake 2, Quake 3, and Doom 3. Every line of code in those engines passed through that specific membrane keyboard with built-in speakers. The tools shaped the work. Carmack's choice wasn't arbitrary. It was an engineering decision about the interface between intention and output. But the real story here is the ergonomic arc. Some gloss progression from Model M to Argodox, easy to Moonlander, mirrors what happens in every mature craft. You start by optimizing for feel and sound, the aesthetics of the tool. Then your body starts talking back, and you optimize for sustainability. The Argodox EZ solved his RSI. He bought two. He 3D printed custom legs to get the tilt right. When those legs kept slipping, he moved to the moon lander. What's beautiful about this ecosystem is that it's almost entirely open. The Ergodox is open source hardware. QMK firmware lets you reprogram every key. The community shares layouts, prints custom cases, designs new switch mounts. Compare that to a laptop keyboard engineered in a sealed facility in Cupertino, where the travel distance is a trade secret, and the butterfly mechanism fails if a grain of sand looks at it wrong. The comments underscore this. People running dactyl menu forms, custom layouts, ortholiner splits, each one a personal instrument tuned to a specific pair of hands. 1,000 small decisions made by the person who actually has to type. The tools we touch most should be the tools we control most. Keyboards got this right. So what happens when you apply that same obsessive optimization, not to hardware, but to how AI models remember things? I've spent enough cycles moving tensors around to know the dirty secret of retrieval engineering. The math is beautiful. The storage bill is not. Late interaction models, like Colbert, give you this gorgeous fine-grained matching, where every token gets its own vector, hundreds of them per document, and the ranking quality jumps because you're comparing structure to structure instead of mashing everything into one big number. But then you multiply that by 2.5 billion documents, and someone has to explain the object storage invoice to accounting. Mixbread just published their solution, and it's one of those ideas that makes you wonder why it took this long. The insight is simple. Documents sit in storage for months or years. Queries happen once and disappear. These are fundamentally different workloads with different precision requirements. So treat them differently. Store document vectors as single bit signs. Basically just positive or negative for each dimension, and keep query vectors at int 8 precision. That's asymmetric quantization. The query side does the heavy lifting with 8 bits of resolution. The document side just needs to point in roughly the right direction. The numbers are striking. A multi-vector document drops from 393 kilobytes in full float 32 down to about 12 kilobytes in this scheme. That's a 32x reduction. And the quality loss? 0.6 of a point on NDCG at 10. You're paying roughly single vector storage costs and getting late interaction quality. That changes the economics from a late interaction is a premium feature for customers who justify the cost to late interaction is the default. Pull this thread a bit further. The retrieval engine underneath, Silo, runs on object storage with tiered hydration. Every byte you shave off a document vector multiplies across billions of records, which means faster cold starts, cheaper shards, less bandwidth per carry. This is infrastructure engineering where the clever bit isn't a new algorithm. It's recognizing that symmetry was never a requirement. One commenter asks about latency trade-offs, which is fair. Storage is only half the story, but compact representations tend to help latency too, because you're reading less data per query. Fewer bytes through the memory bus is fewer bytes through the memory bus, regardless of what your benchmark says about precision. The real win here is that this kind of optimization makes powerful retrieval accessible to teams that don't have hyperscaler budgets. When the storage cost drops 97%, the barrier to running sophisticated search drops with it. The tools get cheaper. More people can touch them. That's how it's supposed to work. So we've made search smarter and cheaper, but what if the best knowledge system was one we already had and abandoned? The architecture of a web forum is almost insultingly simple. A database table, rows of text, timestamps, user IDs, maybe a table for threads, a table for posts, a join between them. You could sketch the entire schema on a napkin in 30 seconds. And that simplicity is precisely the point. Ari Lowell Tone Esgangbride, the first web forum software in June of 1994. He apologized for it, said he threw it together in a few days. But pull that thread forward 30 years, and you find something remarkable. The fundamental data model never really changed. PHP, BBV, Bulletin, Discourse, they all store the same thing. Sequential human utterances, organized by topic, readable by anyone. Now compare that to the data model of a modern social platform. You've got follower graphs, engagement scores, algorithmic ranking, attention prediction, ad auction mechanics, content moderation pipelines trained on proprietary datasets. The complexity didn't grow because the problem got harder. The complexity grew because the business model changed. Forums serve conversation. Platforms serve engagement metrics. Those are different engineering problems with different architectures, and the architecture tells you everything about who the system serves. One of the commenters on this piece nails it. After years on Reddit and Hacker News with tree-structured threading, they still prefer the old sequential post format, and there's a real technical insight buried in that preference. Tree structures optimize for finding the best reply. Sequential structures optimize for following a conversation. The data structure shapes the community behavior. Always has. The beautiful thing is that forum software never actually went away. It's open source. It runs on commodity hardware. You can deploy Discourse on a $5 VPS. The barrier isn't technical, and it never was. The barrier is that centralized platforms captured the network effects by making it free to join and expensive to leave. Classic lock-in pattern, dressed up as convenience. But the forums are still there. The code is still free. The schema still fits on a napkin. And the communities that stuck with them. They kept something the platforms couldn't replicate, not because the technology was better, because the incentive structure was honest. Moving on. One commenter posted something worth examining at face value. Quote, "Today, I would not recommend anybody to go into graphics programming. They started in 2001 with the first GeForce cards and watched the field evolve for 25 years. Their argument deserves the strongest possible reading. The tooling is mature. The engines handle most of what studios need. The job market is narrow and specialized. Why would anyone voluntarily walk into a field where Unreal already solved 80% of the problem? Let me play that argument out to its logical end. If graphics programming is a solved problem, then every studio should be shipping identical-looking games. Every film should have converged on the same rendering pipeline. Every real-time application should look the same. They don't. The gap between what engines provide and what shipped products actually need is where graphics programmers live. And that gap is not shrinking." DemoFox's guide is interesting precisely because of how clearly it maps the territory. Modern rendering splits into two disciplines. CPU side work means wrangling explicit AP is like Vulkan or DirectX 12. Managing memory, scheduling GPU work, loading assets. GPU side work means the mathematics of light transport, physically based rendering, shadows, ambient occlusion. The guide's central advice is blunt and correct. Do not try to learn both simultaneously. Pick one. Use training wheels for the other. The resource chain matters here. Ray tracing in 1 weekend. Learn OpenGL's PBR section. Google's filament documentation. The full PBRT textbook, free online. Every single resource in this pipeline is openly available. No paywall, no institutional access required. A person with a laptop and an internet connection has the same curriculum as a graduate student at a research university. That is not a small thing. Another commenter built a frame, a WebGL framework that's been a gateway to 3D graphics for a decade. Someone else shared a 4-page linear algebra tutorial. The comment section is functioning as a distributed syllabus, each person adding the resource that unlocked their own understanding. The field is narrow, the math is dense, the iteration cycles are long. None of that makes it a bad bet. It makes it a field where the people who show up with working code on a public repository have an asymmetric advantage over people with credentials alone. DemoFox says as much. Build something that loads assets, renders them with PBR lighting, and put it on GitHub. The proof is in the pixels, and the tools to generate those pixels have never been more accessible. We've been talking about proving yourself with working code all episode. Now, here's a benchmark that takes that idea seriously. 24%, that's the top score on senior stool bench right now, achieved by Opus 4.8, meaning the best coding agent on the planet fails 3 out of 4 tasks designed to test whether it can think like a senior engineer. And the benchmark is open source, so you can watch it fail in public. Here's what senior stool bench actually measures, and why it matters more than the original. Regular stool bench gives you a bug and says fix it. Senior stool bench gives you something closer to what lands in your inbox on a Monday morning. A product requirement, some context about the code base, and the implicit expectation that you'll figure out the rest. The example task in the benchmark asks you to add Google Books as a fallback metadata source to OpenLibrary's Bookworm system. It specifies the what. It deliberately underspecifies the how. That gap between specification and implementation is where senior engineering actually lives. One commenter nailed the fundamental tension. Any static benchmark eventually gets memorized. The value of a senior engineer is applying known strategies to novel problems. A frozen test suite can't stay novel forever. That's true, and it's also why this benchmark being open source is the whole point. Fork it. Extend it. Add your own tasks. The benchmark isn't a finish line. It's a calibration tool. And calibration tools improve when 1,000 people contribute edge cases instead of one company guarding a leaderboard. Another commenter called the tasteful Solvos metric codified cargo culting. Fair pushback. But strip away the subjectivity and you're left with something real. Does the agent's patch make the codebase worse? Does it introduce abstractions nobody asked for? That's not taste. That's entropy management, and it's measurable if you're honest about it. The deeper comedy here is that we built a benchmark to test whether A, I can do senior engineering, and the benchmark itself is a senior engineering artifact. Underspecified requirements. Ambiguous success criteria. Stakeholders who disagree about what good means. The test is the thing it's testing for. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for July 2nd, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Script by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quinn3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that's truly yours. We'll see you back here tomorrow.